eastern world. It is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating.
But you tell me over and over and over.
Eve of Destruction, a song penned by a young P.F. Sloan in California in 1964. Listening to Connecting the Notes, I'm your host Matthew Ray, and P.F. Sloan is our guest this hour. He took the time to talk with the show from Southern California earlier in the week, and we'll be hearing plenty of that interview in the coming hour. P.F. Sloan was a significant behind-the-scenes musician and songwriter in the 1960s, playing or writing for the likes of The Grassroots, Jan and Dean, The Mamas and the Papas, Barry McGuire, Herman's Hermits, The Turtles, and Johnny Rivers. Sloan broke into the music industry at an early age, being partnered up with Steve Barry as a staff writer for Screen Gems and later Dunhill Records. We'll learn all about his life in music and listen to some great tunes this hour, so thank you all for tuning in.
I didn't cry, I just stood and watched her say goodbye. She closed the door and said, I don't want to see you anymore. Things I should have said to her that maybe would have changed her mind to stay. Things I should have said to her, love you, so let love find a way. Was it that she just couldn't understand a man like me? Was I to blame? Did I leave too many things unexplained? Things I should have said to her would have changed her mind to stay. Things I should have said to her, like, girl, I love you, so let love find a way. Oh, why didn't I try telling her she was all I had? Why didn't I try telling her now she's gone and I feel oh so bad? But I didn't try, I just stood and watched her say goodbye. She closed the door, said, I don't want to see you anymore. Oh, I should have said to her, I should have said to her.
I guess I want to know how you got your first deal with Aladdin Records and how you got the attention of that label at such a young age.
Wow. Yeah. I was babysitting for a German couple, and they had this this broken ukulele, had one string on it, and I would just harmonize to the one string Everly Brothers songs and things like that. And they gave me the ukulele. Now, this is when I was about 12 years old, and my parents got tired of listening to me harmonizing with the ukulele. So at around 12, they went to the store and got a guitar for me. Basically, the whole story, and I'm sorry that it goes on a bit. I'll try and cut it down.
Oh, no, please, elaborate.
I went to the music store where they bought it, and Elvis Presley was there. This was like 1958, and he actually taught me how to play guitar that day and told me that I would do fine, and I read in a newspaper they were having auditions for Aladdin Records, which was an old black R&B label, as hope some of the people out there know. They had some great artists like Shirley and Lee, you know, Come On Baby, Let the Good Times Roll, and Thurston Harris, Do What You Did. Some of them just escaped me right there. Anyway, I went to audition. There was a huge line of people, and I went in, and I did an Elvis Presley song, I Don't Care If the Sun Don't Shine, and they wound up giving me a contract. Wound up going into the studio, recording it at RCA, where Presley recorded, and the Blossoms sang background, and Elvis's on-the-road guitarist, Mike Deasy, played guitar. It's not a very good record, but, you know, it was my first thing at writing songs and performing. So there it is.
And how old were you at that time?
I was 12 and a half.
12 and a half.
Yeah.
And was it by the time you were...
I was a has-been by the time I was 13.
Yeah. By the time you were 16, you had a deal with Screen Gems? You became a staff writer for them?
Yeah, I became... that's true. I became a staff writer and an A&R at Screen Gems Columbia. I would go there after school and listen to demos from songwriters all over the country, and found some demos by a new group called the Beatles, and played them for my boss, and he didn't like it, threw them in the waste paper basket, and I offered him $5 for them, and he wound up calling Brian Epstein, and wound up getting the Beatles on VJ Records, which was their first release. Love Me Do, I believe, was on VJ.
Well, I don't care if the sun don't shine. I get my loving in the evening time when I'm with my baby. Well, it ain't no fun with the sun around. I get going when the sun goes down and I'm with my baby. Well, that's when we're gonna kiss and kiss and kiss and kiss, and we're gonna kiss some more. Well, who cares how many times we kiss? Cause at a time like this, who keeps score? Well, I don't care if the sun don't shine. I get my loving in the evening time when I meet my baby.
When you went to Dunhill Records, you mentioned you had done A&R before at Screen Gems. So you weren't your typical 9-to-5 songwriter sitting in a cubicle pumping out songs. You seemed to be involved in the whole business, every aspect of it.
I wish I thought it was a business. I mean, to me, it was just fun, you know, all the records I could steal, and being able to listen to, to all the great music that was happening. There was Carole King and Jerry Goffin, Barry Mann, and Howard Greenfield, and I was on the West Coast, they were on the East Coast, I was 16, they didn't really much care about what was coming out of the West Coast, but I did get an education, and I think I did some good there.
Bye.
The Fifth Dimension with their version of the P.F. Sloan, Steve Barry composition, Another Day, Another Heartache, released in 1967 on Buddha Records. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Connecting the Notes, and we're talking with P.F. Sloan this hour, the songwriter and musician who wrote Eve of Destruction, Secret Agent Man, You Baby, and Where Were You When I Needed You, among many others. P.F. Sloan got his start in music doing songwriting and A&R while still in high school. He was teamed up with fellow songwriter Steve Barry while at Screen Gems, and when Lou Adler left and founded Dunhill Records, he brought Sloan and Barry along with him. A lot of their early success came working with surf rock outfits such as Jan and Dean and the Fantastic Baggies. Here's Sloan talking about his relationship with Steve Barry.
And when did you start writing with Steve Barry?
Well, they threw him in the mix when I was about 17. Basically he would kind of just listen to the songs that I wrote and kind of nod up or down or add a word or two. But I really enjoyed having someone to be there and work with. It was a good relationship on that level.
So did you kind of divide and conquer when you two wrote songs together, or was it very collaborative, or like, what was the dynamic between you two? And
well, you know, Mr. Barry really didn't play any instrument. And, you know, at this time I was just learning about life and music, and we were writing follow-ups for the Drifters, and that's what Screen Gems writers did. They wrote follow-ups to things, and never really got anything going until I wrote some songs on my own. Later on, for a number of songs, you know, Steve and I would sort of collaborate on lyric, but that's about all.
Hey, there's gonna be a great big party at my house. La 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 la, that's cool. But I'm charging $2 to get it to my house.
I really enjoyed a lot of the stuff by the Fantastic Baggies, which was one of the first groups that you wrote for. And actually, I was wondering who was in that group, because I've heard your name mentioned, I've heard other names mentioned, and I was wondering who the musicians were in the Fantastic Baggies.
Yeah, that was basically Steve Barry and myself. Jan Barry from Jan and Dean had just gotten rid of the Matadors. They had sung on Surf City and Jan's first album, and he put Steve and I as background singers on all of his records after that, and decided to write surf songs. I mean, I was a water baby, pretty much, living in L.A., you know, would go to the beach all the time. But, I mean, I was just basically influenced by, what I saw in magazines and Jan Berry and Brian Wilson. But it was mostly Steve Barry and myself singing all the harmonies and stuff.
And that kind of led to work with Jan and Dean?
Yeah, we wound up singing on all their records. Little Old Lady from Pasadena, the Drag City, basically all their hits. Steve and I, Fantastic Baggies, are singing on it. So that was a lot of fun to do. I mean, it was my first encounter with rock stars, and certainly Jan Berry was a really handsome rock star and a good producer. Learned some stuff from him. Sort of Brian Wilson, I'm positive to say about that.
Hey, Mom, if any of the guys from my baseball team ever call me on the phone to ask me to play in an important game, just say their captain ain't at home. Tell them I'm surfing.
Don't care about hitting home runs.
Tell them
now.
I'm surfing.
Wanna have me some fun now.
I'm trading in my bat and ball, say I'll see them in the fall. I'm going surfing. And if that pretty little girl from across the street, who's been bothering me for days, to go swimming in her pool, well, her pool's real cool, but it hasn't got 10-foot waves. Tell her I'm surfing.
She's a mighty, mighty cute girl.
Tell her I'm surfing.
But I might be shooting the
girl. If she wants my company, I'll be out at wind and sea. I'm going surfing. Last year I had a summer job, and all day long I had to run around. But now I can't afford a new surfboard, and all summer long I'm gonna bum around. So just pack me a lunch and I'll be on my way. Oh yeah, there's one more thing to do. If the mailman comes with a letter for me, just forward it to Malibu, where I'll be surfing.
Just drop it in my 34 Ford.
Tell them I'm surfing.
I'll be the one waxing my board now.
I won't be home for days. I'll be riding the waves. I'm going surfing. I'm going surfing.
Gonna throw my books away.
I'm going surfing.
24 hours a day.
I won't be home for days. I'll be riding the waves. I'm going surfing. I'm going surfing. I'm going surfing. I'm going surfing. I'm
going surfing. I'm going surfing. I was sitting on the beach just picking up some sun when my buddy ran up to me.
Thank you.
Jan and Dean with One Piece Topless Bathing Suit, a song written by Sloan and Barry. And before that, the Fantastic Baggies with Tell 'Em I'm Surfin'. You heard P.F. Sloan talking about those two groups and the surf rock of the time. Before those songs, you heard a song by the Street Cleaners called That's Cool, That's Trash. Sloan recorded that song when he was just 16, between demo recordings, and Bell Records picked it up, releasing the song under the band name The Street Cleaners. The record caught the attention of the Kingsmen, who recorded the song on their third album. The Street Cleaners weren't the only band P.F. Sloan was pulling the strings for in the background. He was also the primary songwriter and featured guitarist in many of the early Grassroots recordings. Here's Sloan talking about the Grassroots.
And let's see, another group I was kind of interested in is the Grassroots, and it's another kind of platform it seemed like Dunhill used to release a lot of your songs. And that was a revolving cast of musicians as well. Can you kind of break down the evolution of that group, at least early on when you were involved?
Yeah, sure. I was very, very prolific at this time, writing quite a lot of songs, and most of the groups in Los Angeles were recording them, but I was still writing a number of songs, and since Dunhill really didn't want me to be a recording artist, they wanted to keep me as a songwriter. They decided to start a group called the Grassroots, and I would be the lead singer. But what they would do is they would get a make-believe group, a Milli Vanilli kind of thing, to actually go out on the road for it. So put together the Grassroots and put together a song that I wrote, Where Were You When I Needed You. Actually, the first song of the Grassroots was Mr. Jones, Ballad of a Thin Man. And that came about with a meeting with Bob Dylan. And he gave me the song to record, and so we started the Grassroots to record Ballad of a Thin Man. And I went to San Francisco, found a group, Bill Fulton, and brought them back to Los Angeles. They put their vocals over mine, and they became the Grassroots. I wanted them to be self-sufficient. I wanted them to learn to write their own songs and produce themselves, but that wasn't the case.
Did you play any instruments on any Grassroots recordings that they put out?
Yeah, I'm playing all the guitars and organ, piano, and harmonicas, and all that stuff. We used the Wrecking Crew, the same people that were working for the Beach Boys, Mamas and Papas, Jan and Dean. It was the Wrecking Crew in L.A. So there would be Hal Blaine on drums and Joe Osborne on bass, and I'd be playing guitar, piano, and organ.
Don't bother crying, don't bother crawling, it's all over now, no use in stalling. The love I once felt, I don't feel anymore for you. This time I'll even open the door for you. You walked out when I was down. Well, now I'm well off. And look, look who's coming round. Where were you when I needed you? Where were you when I wanted you? Good. It's hard to fight it, but no use explaining. I've already decided that living with you, it's worse than without you. I won't spend a lifetime all worrying about you. All things got rough and you disappeared. Now I'm back on my feet, but look, look who's standing there. So young and you were so wild. I knew you were nobody's innocent child. That first day I saw you, you really got to me. I thought I could change you, what good did it do me? All things got rough and you wouldn't wait. Now you're tripping back, but babe, babe, it's too late.
The Grassroots from 1966 with Where Were You When I Needed You. The Grassroots were the brainchild of Dunhill Records songwriter and recording artist P.F. Sloan. Here's Sloan talking about Dunhill Records.
When you went to Dunhill Records, was there a feeling that you guys were breaking new ground, or was this just the thing, were record labels just popping up in this time and it was just the, you know, the thing to do?
No, the idea of Dunhill Records was basically, It was basically they were interested in selling album catalogs. They didn't expect to have any success, and they certainly didn't want the songs that I began writing on my own, Eve of Destruction and Sins of a Family. And when I took them in to the boss to play them for them, you know, they didn't like them at all. They threw them in the wastebasket, and they just said, you know, go back to writing surf songs. But no, they weren't interested in breaking new ground. They went kicking and screaming. You know, by the time Three Dog Night came in, you know, Dunhill was really avant-garde, but it they really didn't understand pop music, rock music. It basically just happened. Okay? You know, it wasn't that they were, like, seeking it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It just happened, and they didn't really much like it, you know. I think they wanted to be like Columbia, you know, they wanted to have a Barbra Streisand or something.
P.F. Sloan is best known for writing the controversial Eve of Destruction. He describes the song as a prayer to his generation. In the song, Sloan warns the world about war and the advent of nuclear weapons. Barry McGuire recorded the song in 1965, and it got significant radio airplay, making its way to number one on the Billboard charts. Reaction to the song was strong and swift. Many folk musicians, still weary of the ever-growing rock and roll influence, dismissed the song as an insincere attempt to cash in on a trend of the time. Writers, critics, and talking heads on the radio and television called McGuire out for encouraging America's enemies and being anti-patriotic. The song provoked the group The Spokesmen to release an answer song to the track called The Dawn of Correction. Many radio stations, not wanting to offend their listening audience, banned both songs from airplay. Still, others praised the song for its insight and its cry for protest, and many musicians would cover the song in coming years. Protesters would also use the song as a rallying cry in their quest to get the voting age changed from 21 to 18. We spoke with P.F. Sloan about writing the song and the reaction it received.
So, I mean, and you mentioned Eve of Destruction, and it's amazing the feedback that song got at the time. I mean, there are people saying the song encouraged America's enemy, and that actually prompted an answer song like The Dawn of Correction. Were you surprised when you wrote it, the response it got from the public when Barry McGuire, when it got on the radio?
Yeah, very much so. It was staggering what it did to my psyche. It basically just was a prayer, you know, talking to my generation, you know, about how to be able to fix some of the problems that I was encountering. Nobody had any idea that a certain group of people now called the right wing would call it anti-American, and came down pretty heavy on my young, poor psyche. But that's the way it goes, eh?
Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. My blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration when human respect is disintegrating. This whole crazy world is just too frustrating, and you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace. And tell me
And, I mean, a lot of groups, I don't know if a lot, I know the Turtles turned it down before Barry Maguire got a hold of it. Was there anybody kind of whispering in your ear that this would have the kind of effect it had? And, I mean, would you even care? Because it's a great song and, you know, it's art.
No, I didn't really care. As I said, I played it for the record label, and they didn't want to publish the song. They didn't want to publish any of my songs at that point, the ones that I was writing on my own. The record actually was the backside of the Barry Maguire record, which was Eve of Destruction. It was actually the backside. The A-side was called What's Exactly the Matter with Me, a song that Barry liked and signed with Dunhill to be able to record that song. He didn't particularly like Eve of Destruction. Nobody did. You know, it just, it happened because it was meant to happen. I don't know why.
Why do I deny all that's accepted true? Why can't I live my life like I'm expected to? Get a college degree, buy a color TV. What's exactly the matter with me? I believe no one's conclusions, I think for myself. I take nothing for granted, my brain ain't on a shelf. Oh, I got my views, though I miss and confuse. What's exactly the matter with me? Why can't I settle down in one little place? Find me a girl and get out of this race. But my boots, they start itching. My eyes, they start looking. What's exactly the matter with me? Why can't I march when the cause is just? Stamp out oppression, greed and lust. Oh, inferiority, pent up hostility. That's exactly the matter with me. Why do I yes people that I despise? Why can't I see I hate you right to your eyes? Oh, inferiority, pent up hostility. That's exactly the matter with me. That's exactly the matter with me.
P.F. Sloan performing his song, What's Exactly the Matter with Me? Barry McGuire covered that song on the A-side of his 1965 record, but it was the B-side, Eve of Destruction, that got the most attention. Eve of Destruction was originally offered to the Turtles, who turned it down. Singer Howard Kalin told journalist Richie Unterberger that although they loved the song, the group wasn't a good fit for such a bold single, saying, quote, "We explained to him that we were young, white, middle-class kids from the suburb and had very little to protest, actually. Then we asked if he had anything else, and he played the song Let Me Be for us. Ah, just the perfect level of rebellion, haircuts and nonconformity. That was as far as we were willing to go. Even then we knew that we wouldn't be singing protest songs much longer," end quote. Here are the Turtles with a P.F. Sloan song they found more to their liking called Let Me Be.
Please don't mistake me or try to make me the shadow of anybody else. I ain't the him or her you think I am. I'm just trying hard to be myself. Whole society's goal is to be part of the whole. It may sound good to you, not to me. Stand to be understood. I could never give in to or ever live up to being like you think I should. I've got some inner need which I'm trying to heed. I can't take any change me or rearrange me to satisfy the selfishness in you. I'm not a piece of clay to mold to your moves each day, and I'm not a pawn to be told how to move. I'm sorry I'm not the fool you thought would play by your rules, but to each his own.
Turtles with Let Me Be. That song was written by P.F. Sloan, as were other songs by the Turtles, including You Baby, Can I Get to Know You Better, and Is It Any Wonder. We are featuring the music of P.F. Sloan this hour, and were able to interview him earlier in the week. In addition to songwriting, P.F. Sloan was an underappreciated singer and guitarist and released two solo albums during his time with Dunhill Records. Sloan felt Dunhill would not promote him because they wanted to keep him as a songwriter for the label. We asked him what the recording sessions were like, and here's what he had to say.
We know you didn't receive much publicity when you put the solo albums out, mainly because they wanted to keep you as a songwriter, but did you have support in the actual recording of it? Did you have kind of free range and as much studio time as you wanted and respect when it came to actually recording the album?
No, you know, just a heads up as to what Dunhill was about. Dunhill was about a three-hour session, and you needed to get four masters in 3 hours. So that's basically how the albums were done.
So even with your insider and all that you did, you only got a limited amount of time to lay down your records, huh?
Yeah, it's basically 3 hours, 3 hours for four songs, and then if you're lucky to get some extra money, they'll give you like 4 hours for overdubbing.
Wow.
And then maybe 10 hours for mixing, and then, you know, that's it.
And did you have access to any, you know, studio musicians like Hale Blaine and the Wrecking Crew and those guys?
Yeah, I did on the second. I did on the second album for Dunhill, but it was all basically done as demos, not as master recordings. In other words, they weren't really scheduled. They were just done at like 8 a.m, you know, for $15. If you can believe that, that's the way it worked in those days.
Think you look cute in your tin-plated suit. You don't need a can opener to get through to you. The wig hat on your head keeps your mind thick and straight. You're the Duchess of Vin, dancing on a golden plate. Woo-wee, Halloween Mary. Rules are just tools for you to use when you feel. Nothing's real. Your bell-bottom knees always keeps you in style. Even a swami thinks you're wild for an October child. Woo! Pretty scary, Halloween Mary. With your hypnotic eyes, you see through everyone. The saran wrap bodies start looking for some place to run. Your pointed red fingernails.
Sloan left Dunhill Records shortly after the release of his second album. In order to get out of his contract, he was forced to sign away the rights to all of his songs. After leaving Dunhill, he would spend the majority of two decades out of music and the public eye. He spent a lot of time battling hypoglycemia and depression. Here's Sloan talking a bit about this period.
And you left Dunhill, and I know you had to unfortunately sign away rights and that, but once you left, was there anything preventing you from finding other work, or were you just so disillusioned with the whole thing at such a young age that you didn't even, you know, what happened when you got out of Dunhill?
Well, Dunhill basically prohibited me from ever recording again. I mean, you know that saying, you know, you'll never work in this town again, kid. Basically, anyone that was interested, Dunhill would say that, you know, we owned the rights to him, and we will sue you if you record him. So, basically, you know, it was Dunhill just wanting to take all the gold and the booty from the work that I did and make sure that I never worked again. Wasn't exactly a productive time for me, but it was quite a learning experience to learn what life is really about. It served me well.
Did you have much support during your illnesses from musicians you had worked with in the past? And not to drop any names, but did you find that community a place to fall back on, or were you felt really alienated from it?
No, there really wasn't much of a community, unfortunately. And there was a number of people on Dunhill that were pretty broken up over the years. You know, the guys from Three Dog Night, Chuck Negron, just the way that they treated artists was so bad that it really destroyed a lot of fragile psyches. No, I basically had to. I got divine help, and there really wasn't anything else. They had no cure for hypoglycemia, and they considered catatonia a mental illness, and so it was just basically just self-healing and much divine help. You know, having to be under.
The Mamas and the Papas with California Dreamin', released in 1966. That first album by the Mamas and Papas featured P.F. Sloan on guitar. After P.F. Sloan left Dunhill Records, he resurfaced for a couple of albums on smaller labels, but essentially disappeared from music and the public eye. It prompted Jimmy Webb to write and perform the song P.F. Sloan. Webb is best known for his song By the Time I Get to Phoenix, and was a friend of Sloan who met him through their work with The Fifth Dimension and Johnny Rivers. Sloan has resurfaced and is feeling healthy again. He released an album in 2006 and is currently working on new material. Here's P.F. Sloan talking about his road to recovery.
You know, having to be underground for a long, long time kind of shot my nervous system, and I went into some serious illnesses, hypoglycemia and depression and catatonia for about 7-18 years. It wasn't until I met a holy man in India by the name of Sai Baba that I began to get healing from my maladies. And I think by 1995, about 20 years of healing, a friend of mine from Nashville had been asking me to record for a long time, and I thought I'm about mentally ready and physically able to do it and enjoy it. So we went into Nashville and worked for about 14 days straight, and came up with the Sailover album, which I'm pleased with, really pleased with. But you know, there wasn't much time for overdubbing, but I'm pretty glad with the outcome of it.
The album Sailover was released in 2006. It contained an updated version of his 1960s single Sins of a Family, with Lucinda Williams contributing vocals.
Mother, whose mind was in the gutter, would have sold herself to the devil gladly. Oh, what a sad environment, a bug-ridden tenement. And when they couldn't pay the rent, it's 'cause her father was out getting liquor. Out of stone's been cast, and blood is thicker than water. Sins of a family fall on a daughter. Yeah, the sins of a family fall on a daughter.
At the age of 16, she has been around more than any girl over 30. And the high IQs on the high school news, calling you a product of poor heredity. It's a well-known fact, if you fall on your back, you can backtrack failure with inspection. Such few exceptions.
All the sins of a family fall on the daughter. Live a lie and then expect when you die to have your soul in paradise.
You know you have to pay the price, you're like you ought to. And if blood is thicker than water,
then the sins of a family fall on the daughters. Yeah, the sins of a family.
Thank you.
Thank you all for tuning in. Thanks to P.F. Sloan for taking the time to talk with the show. If you'd like more information about the show, visit us online at connectingnotes.com. We're going to end the show with another big hit for Sloan and Barry as performed by Johnny Rivers. The original was called Secret Danger Man and was written for a British TV series, Danger Man.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. With every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number and taken away your name. Faces that you find, a pretty face can hide an evil mind. Oh, be careful what you say, or you give yourself away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret. Number.